Well, hello, hello, and welcome to the Hungarian Living Podcast. I'm your host, Liz Szabó-Vas, and I'm excited about our guest today, Doug Cantrell. Doug knows a lot about coal mining and immigrants, and just a little snippet about my history is that I had several family members involved in the coal mining industry in Pennsylvania and Kentucky, and I have been learning a lot about this topic over the last year, and there is so much to learn. So, Doug is a professor of history in the Kentucky Community and Technical College System, where he has taught since 1987. And he is considered the foremost expert on immigrants in the Appalachian coal industry. He has authored, co-authored, edited, or contributed to 14 books, written articles about immigration for both the Encyclopedia of Appalachia and the Kentucky Encyclopedia, and contributed articles and book reviews about immigrants in Southern Appalachia to several academic journals. He is currently working on a book about immigrants in the coal fields of the Appalachian South. And I am thankful that even though he has a very busy schedule, that he is willing to visit with me today on the podcast. So welcome, Doug.
Well, thank you, Liz, for those kind words. I'm glad to be here. Enjoy doing this kind of stuff.
Well, that's awesome. So let's talk a little bit about what drew your interest into coal mining and how you got interested in researching and writing about immigrants in the coal fields.
Well, that's sort of two different things. In terms of coal mining, I come from a coal mining family on both sides of my mother and father. Both grandparents were coal miners. My father, there were 13 or 11 kids in the family. Not only was his father coal miners, but my father was, and his four brothers were coal miners. And in my mother, there were seven kids in the family. She was the only girl, but all her brothers, along with her father, were coal miners. And they, most of them worked in a coal mine all their life, retired, or either got black lung, had to quit early. And so that I always had a natural interest in coal mining. Even as a kid, we would play as coal miners. What we wanted to be, we wanted to be coal miners. We wanted to play, we would play trucks and that sort of thing and haul dirt, pretend it was coal. Immigrants, it's kind of an interesting story how I got into researching immigrants. I was in high school. I don't remember the exact year, sometime in the 1970s, probably 1975 or 76, 77 maybe. Was sitting there with nothing to do, and we lived in a small town in Virginia called Richlands. And this little town had a weekly newspaper, and it came out every Wednesday. And so I was sitting there one Wednesday reading the newspaper. And it had an article about immigrant coal miners in a coal camp in Virginia called Jewel Ridge. And that struck a chord with me because my grandfather had worked at Jewel Ridge, and the article was about immigrant coal miners. Well, I, like most people, had grown up in the mountains thinking that there was only Anglo-Saxon Protestant people in the mountains. I didn't know there were any Hungarians, Italians, and Russian and Polish people. And yet this article in that little newspaper talked about that a camp of those people at Jewel Ridge, Virginia, which my grandfather retired from. He worked at mine most of his life. And so I read it and found it interesting. Didn't think anything about it. And then I went to college and went to Berea College and spent 4 years there. And then I decided to go and do a master's and a PhD at the University of Kentucky. And while I was in graduate school at the University of Kentucky, my first year, I took a class with the immigration professor, Dr. Humbert Nelly. And we had like five or six people in the class. So he moved us out of the classroom and took us to his office. He had a conference table, and we were sitting around his office. And most days, we had to choose a topic to read on. And we would read a book or two a week and just talk to other students about the book we'd read. And so one day he changed things up and he went around the table and he asked everybody, he said, "What do you want to write your doctoral dissertation on?" Well, I was the first person in my family to ever go to college. And so I had no idea. I'd even thought about it. I didn't know how graduate school worked. But I had
That's pretty far away from
and
your.
I didn't want to sound stupid.
Yeah.
Like I didn't know what was going on. And so when it came to me, I happened to just remember that newspaper article, and I knew that Dr. Nelly was the immigration expert. And so I said, "Well, Dr. Nelly, I'm going to write my dissertation on immigrants in the Appalachian coal fields." And that was a topic never been written about before. And so Dr. Nelly immediately started gushing about that. He demanded that he my dissertation that I worked with him. Well, I'd wanted to work with Harry Caldwell, which was the Appalachian scholar. So I worked out a deal where that Mr. Caldwell and Dr. Nelly both would oversee my graduate.
Nice.
So they teamed up, and Caldwell was the Appalachian person and Nelly was the immigration person. So that's how I got into it. And I began to then, that was a bit like, that had been like 1983. Mm-hmm. And I've been writing, reading about, researching immigrants in the Appalachian coal field since then. So it's sort of an interesting story.
That is interesting, how it
newspaper article.
Well, and your grandfather's connection to it, you know, so that's why you read the article connection. And then, you know, it just all, did you know your grandfather? Did you ever ask him about the immigrants being there?
No, I didn't. He was in the last year or two of his life. That grandfather, I think, probably died by then.
Okay.
Yeah, he had died. He died in about 1972 or three. So he'd been dead a few years. No, I never asked him about them. Mm-hmm. The other grandfather was alive, but he didn't work for the immigrants. As far as I know, he never said anything about it. I didn't really think about it then. I didn't really pay much mind to it until that was like probably 76 or 77. I didn't pay any mind to it until 83. And it just happened to stick in my mind and come out that day for some reason in that class. So.
Well, and it set the course of your life.
It set the course of my life. It sure did. Now, I did a program several years ago called History Alive, a TV program. It was a guest on a TV program, History Alive. And they asked me that, and I told them a little story. And at the end of the program, the interviewer asked me, she said, what do you plan to do in the future? And I said, I really have no plans. I'll just do research on where it leads me. Mm-hmm. And so she liked that answer. And that's what I plan to do, just keep on, you know, where it leads me, whatever I uncover.
Following the path.
Until I die.
Yep. Well, that's awesome. That's, you know, you've got a lot of history behind you as far as, you know, you've got the knowledge base. And so things will just keep uncovering as you go. So let's talk a little bit, you know, we're talking about the immigrants. And so as we set the stage for this discussion, you know, what's the big picture history of people coming to the United States?
Well, you know, I like to tell my students, we are all immigrants. I'll tell them, nobody in this classroom that is not an immigrant. And I use that in context to say, you know, why are we so anti-immigrant? Are many people so anti-immigrant now? I said, every one of us will have relatives who is an immigrant at some point in time. And I say, and somebody say, well, what about the Native Americans? I say, well, they were too. So if you look at, you know, at least, you know, Native Americans came from probably Central Asia. They were the first immigrants. They came at least 35,000, maybe longer, years ago. And then you have a number of different periods of immigration to what is today the United States. You have what historians call the original settlers. And those were people mostly from England, some from Germany, some from Denmark, some from Norway, some from Sweden, some from the Netherlands. They mostly came from about 1600 until about the time of the American Revolution, about 1775 or so. And then you have a second wave of immigration that goes from about the end of the American Revolution to about 1880. And the historians call those people the old immigrants. Well, let me go back a little bit. The old immigrants from about 1775 until about 1880 or so. That would be your Scotch-Irish who settled in the Appalachian Mountains, some German settlers, a lot of Irish settlers who came because of the potato famine. German settlers came because there was revolution going on in Germany. If you know about the history of Germany, it wasn't really a country until 1870, 1871, but it was a collection of about 300 little kingdoms, and those kingdoms were being unified into modern Germany in the 1830s, 1840s, and that disrupted the economy and life for a lot of people. And so many Germans came in the 1840s, 1850s. And then you have a third period of immigration called the new immigrants, which is what I deal with mostly. Mm-hmm. And that began about 1880 and lasted until, well, most historians say 1920, but really about 1915, because World War I is going to stop it. But this is when the Italian, the Hungarians, the Russians, the Polish people, the Czechoslovakians, the Austrians, people from Syria and Lebanon, a lot of Jewish people from Russia came into the United States. And then from about 1945 to the present, you have then what historians call recent immigrants, and that would be Latinos and Asian people, people from South America, Central America, Mexico, the Philippines, Korea, Japan, China. And so that's the big picture, the different periods of immigration. Now I deal with the new immigrants from about 1880 to about the beginning of World War I. And those are the immigrants who mostly worked the coal mines, at least in the area I deal with. Now, some of the old immigrants, the Germans and Scotch-Irish, those people worked the coal mines in Pennsylvania and Ohio. But I deal with mostly West Virginia, Virginia, Eastern Kentucky. Okay. And those were the new immigrants who worked the coal mines in that area, the Hungarians, Italians, that group.
And that's considered the southern coal fields?
Yeah, the southern coal fields from West Virginia down. It goes West Virginia, Virginia, Kentucky, or at least Eastern Kentucky. There are two coal fields in Kentucky, Eastern and Western. Now, the Western one's completely different. It's not part of the Southern. They started mining coal in the Western part of the state in the 1830s, but the Eastern part didn't start until the 19-teens, about almost 80 years or so later. So I deal with that part. Northern Alabama, although I don't deal much with Alabama, Eastern Tennessee, some coal mining went on, but most of it, Virginia, West Virginia, and Eastern Kentucky. And that's where the immigrants were.
Okay. And how many, just to get a big picture, so how many different, so that's this, you know, you work with the southern coal fields, but how many different regions are there for mining or coal mining?
There are at least four or five different coal fields in West Virginia, two or three in Virginia, and at least two or three in Eastern Kentucky. So about eight or nine different coal fields.
Okay.
Or different regions.
Okay.
And in terms of overall numbers, I've discovered that between 64 and 65,000 immigrants worked in the coal fields of West Virginia, Virginia, and Eastern Kentucky between 1880 and 1920.
I'm sorry,
1880 and 1940.
Okay.
And about 7% of those were Hungarian, and about 8 or 9% were Italian. Those are the two largest groups.
Okay.
And then you have 20 or more other groups. You 3 or 4% would be Russian. 3 or 4% might be Polish. Then you might have a percent or two Czechoslovakian, although Czechoslovakia is part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at part of the time anyway, until World War One. But the Italians and Hungarians were the two largest groups. They were neck and neck. Italians outnumbered Hungarians just a little bit, but not much. And in some coal fields, Hungarians were the largest group, some towns.
And have you looked into, or do you have a sense of how they were recruited to come from their countries?
Yeah, there were several different ways they were recruited. Up until the 1880s, I've got a cat getting up here. Come on, girl.
What's her name?
Sabrina.
Sabrina.
Up until the 1880s, mid-1880s, so many steamship companies would recruit immigrants because they needed passengers crossing the Atlantic. And so steamship companies had agents in places, in countries like Hungary, or where Hungary really was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It was one of the largest countries in Europe, or largest empires in Europe at the time until 1919. Mm-hmm. But these steamship companies would send agents to Hungary, Austria, what's now Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Romania, Russia, Poland, Italy, and they would recruit these immigrants might promise them a better life and tell them, you know, how better things were in the United States to get those immigrants to buy passage on their ships. And in 1884, 1885, Congress prohibited that practice. But that didn't stop immigration because overall, about 20 million new immigrants came to the United States. That's a large number. It's the largest number of immigrants who've ever come to this country. And most of them would come at the behest then of employers who were looking for workers. and how that would work if you had, say, Hungarian immigrant working in your factory or your coal mine. You might give that person a few dollars to write letters home to relatives and try to entice relatives to come and work for the same company that person worked for, the same mine. And so that was one big way that immigrants got here, just your family members saying, look, almost all women and children, immigrants who were female and children, immigrants under the age of, say, 18 or so, came that way. And then a lot of times, you know, female immigrants and would get here because they were married and their husband had come before and he would save up enough money to pay their passage over. And if he had daughters, he would pay their passage over, or sons. So a lot of families came that way later on. And then there are a couple of different ways that immigrants got into the coal fields. One way was through recruitment by coal companies. And the coal companies used a system called the padrone system. It's an Italian word meaning father. And the padrone was basically a labor agent. And he would go to immigrant communities in cities, because immigrant groups tended to settle in immigrant neighborhoods. You'd have a Hungarian community, an Italian community, a Polish community, Russian community, whatever. And these agents would go to these communities, and especially saloons where a lot of immigrants would hang out.
Sure.
And they would simply recruit workers, and they would promise them high-paying jobs, which often didn't happen. Yeah, lies. They would get them there. And then another way that coal companies got workers was a method called on transportation. And the on transportation method was when the coal company would promise to, they would do advertisements in the foreign language newspaper. Almost every ethnic group had its own newspapers in northern cities and eastern cities. And so these coal companies take out advertisements in those ethnic newspapers, and they would promise the immigrant high wages. They would promise them free transportation, free housing, free food, free tools, everything to get those immigrants to sign a labor contract. And I've got, actually, in the book I'm writing, I've got copies of a labor contract or two that immigrants signed.
Oh, wow.
But most of the immigrants couldn't speak English well and couldn't read English, and so they didn't know what they were signing. And what the coal company was telling them, to a large extent, was lies. Once the immigrant, what they would do then, with the immigrant agreed to, would sign a contract, a labor contract, agreed to come to, say, someone in West Virginia, Virginia, or Kentucky, working a coal mine, the coal company agent would give the immigrant a railroad ticket and put a tag with their name on the location where they were going, and the immigrant go down to the train station and would be put on a train with other immigrants going to that same location or a location near there. And once the immigrant got there, they'd be taken to a company town built by whatever coal company they're going to work for and given housing there. But they found out that none of it was free. The railroad transportation was promised free, would be deducted from the immigrant's paycheck. The immigrant would have to buy his own tools working the mines, have to buy their own, what the miners called bank clothing, B-A-N-K, bank clothing was what you wore to the coal bank or working in the coal mines. They would have to buy their own blasting powder to shoot coal from the coal seam. They would have to buy their own food. They would buy their own, they use carbide lamps. I don't know if you know what a carbide lamp is, but carbide's a chemical that you put in at a metal lamp on top of your head. And you had two containers, one with water, and you would, that was top container, and you fill the bottom container with the white granules called carbide. Union carbide, you heard the Union Carbide Company?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's what they made.
Okay.
And you would put the granules of carbide in the bottom container, and you turn the valve, and it would drip water all day long, and you would strike a flint on the shield on your head, and you would have a blaze of fire come out, and that would light the tunnel for you. The immigrants have to buy those lamps, and they'd have to buy the carbide to operate those lamps with.
But what a racket!
It was a racket to a large degree, and most immigrants would find that once they got to the company towns, they often would it would be maybe 3 months before they get any real money.
Oh.
Because they would have to pay the company back for the transportation. They would have to pay the company back. They were paid once a month in cash, and the transportation would be deducted from the pay envelope. Housing costs would be deducted. Whether the company charged for the rent of the houses it built. They would have to pay a charge for if a company town had electricity, which most didn't, but some did, pay a charge for that. The houses are heated with coal. They'd pay a charge for the coal to heat the houses with in winter. Then all company towns had doctors that the company hired. Well, they would deduct a certain amount from every pay envelope of every worker to pay the doctor, whether you use the doctor or not. They would, to be ministers in churches, the company would hire the minister, deduct money to pay the minister. So there are all kinds of fees that came out of their pay envelopes, too. Many immigrants were a lot of them, the old song, owe my soul to the company store. Mm. That was to a large extent true, because the immigrants would be so much in debt that it was almost impossible for many of them to leave the coal fields because of the debt.
Mm-hmm.
Caused by the way they were recruited on transportation. And some just, if you read the Martin Himmler autobiography, you'll face that situation. He just left. And many immigrants would just get up and leave because they knew that they were being fleeced.
Right, right. But boy, you got to have some courage to do that too.
Yeah, you're afraid. You're in a strange country. You don't speak the language well. And you don't know the customs. And you don't know whether you're going to go to jail or not. And you're afraid to. And so and that's why some didn't. Some just put up with it. And also, there were some investigations of debt peonage from immigrants from immigrant leaders in the country who, would take this to Congress and nothing much was done about it. But the coal operators had more power than immigrants did. So,
right. Is it true? I mean, I've kind of heard that the hope of the coal mine operator, like the owners, was to keep this variation of immigrants, like from different countries, so that they couldn't really communicate with one another and couldn't like unionize, I guess would kind of be the word, but even just, talk about whatever. So to kind of keep them separate.
Yes. Segregation. Yeah. They were segregated. Housing was segregated. Two different ways to talk about segregated housing in the coal camps. One was there was ethnic and racial segregation. And most, if you've been in you've been to Himmlerville and you know how it looks, the mountains look there and where the coal camp was, the houses down in the valley. A lot of coal camps caused those, they were built along creeks like Himmlerville was. And on the near the creeks would be the houses of immigrants and blacks. Because a lot of African Americans were recruited from the cotton fields of the deep south too.
Okay.
Same time, but the blacks would live in one area. Usually they and the immigrant neighborhoods would be down by the creek. And there was a reason for that, because the creeks flood every year. And so if any damage done, any property destroyed, any houses were washed away, it's going to be the immigrant black houses. And then on the middle of the hill would be the the non-immigrant American, maybe is the best way to call it. Well, the old immigrant or refer to them as Native American or Native white houses. And they were on the middle of the hill because they were less likely to get flooded. And then on the top of the hill, which the miners often called Silk Stocking Road, that's where the mine bosses and mine owners and superintendents, those sort of people live. And their houses were put on top of the hill because they were not going to be in any danger of flooding in the spring when rains came. And so there was segregation that way, but then there was also segregation another way. Immigrant coal operators allowed immigrant miners to live together and in an institution called the boarding boss. And what would happen is that, say, if you were a Hungarian immigrant, and very few immigrants were married, most were single men, but occasionally you'd have a married man with a family. So if you were a Hungarian immigrant and you had wife and children, you would rent a large house, a boarding house and most of these coal companies would be large boarding house, maybe had 20 rooms or so in them. And you would rent a boarding house from the coal company, or the coal company probably encouraged you to rent it. And then you would rent rooms to the for people of your own nationality. If you're Hungarian, you'd rent rooms to Hungarian coal miners working that for that coal mine. And your wife and daughters would then, you would work in the mine. The man was called the boarding boss. That's what the name's called, the boarding boss system. He would work in the mine, but then his wife and daughters would take care of maybe 20 or more immigrant miners that lived in the house.
So they would cook the food.
Mm-hmm. They would clean, wash, do laundry, that sort of thing. And they would pack the lunch buckets or the dinner buckets for the coal miners every day and fix the, you know, and I interviewed several immigrants in Eastern Kentucky when I was working on a dissertation. And they, you know, one was named, she's from Yugoslavia, named Bessie Funick. And she told me, she said she worked in a boarding house in Virginia and then also in Lynch, Kentucky. And she said the work was hard. She said you had to get up 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Begin to cook breakfast for 20 or more men. And then once you got that done, you had to pack their lunch buckets so they would have something to eat at work that day. And then she said you cleaned the house and washed clothes and that sort of thing for them while they were at work. And then when they came back, you had to have supper fixed for them, or they called supper dinner. We would call it dinner. They called supper. You'd have that fixed for them. And she said, you know, she would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and wouldn't get in bed till maybe 10 o'clock at night. She got very little sleep, she said. And she, you know, and her father operated a boarding house for a coal company in Virginia and then in Kentucky. And that I talked to several immigrant women who had that experience, and they, you know, absolutely hated that kind of work. It's almost slave labor.
I would say it's very demanding, but I will say that it is interesting. And I'm sure I've read this in a couple of different books. The idea that if you have the people from the same culture living together, it's easier to live together because you come from a common culture, you have a common language, but also if your cook knows how to cook the food that you are accustomed to, then that's another easier, you know, it's more like home because of the cooking kind of thing.
That's why the institution developed. See, that's the institution that developed new in the mountains. And see, my focus is often on a lot of immigrant institutions that developed and how immigrants live. And that's one reason why that they would live under an ethnic household because, you know, it was like home. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of cooking the food, they would cook what they could from their nationality, but they found that a lot of food that they were used to were not available or was not available in the U.S. And so they adapted.
Right. You could do it as close as you could, but it wouldn't be exact.
Close you could. But coal miners wanted the immigrants to live that way because they hoped it would prevent unionization. Mm-hmm. And they wanted, the immigrants to stay there. And they thought too that they would, you know, if they lived with common culture, sort of like home, they would more likely stay in the mine rather than leave. And that's part of why they did that too. And then work crews were segregated in the coal mine. You'd have Hungarian work crews. You'd have Italian work crews. You'd have Yugoslavian work crews, Czechoslovakian work crews, Polish work crews, Russian work crews. And usually the coal mine operator would select an immigrant who could speak English fairly well, could communicate with the boss, but who could also speak the native language well. And that person would be the foreman of that mine crew, of that ethnic mine crew. And he would then relay orders from the boss to the immigrant workers every day. And he would relay complaints or that sort of thing back from the immigrant workers to the boss. Okay. So there was segregation in both the workplace and in housing.
Okay. And so basically the largest group in the southern coal fields, you said, were Italians, but the Hungarians.
Yeah, they were a little bit larger than Hungarians, not much, just, you know, maybe 2% or so.
Okay. And what happened as far as, or were there certain things that happened as far as mining incidents or accidents that led to better regulation or led to, you know, healthier environment for the workers?
Well, eventually. The big thing that happened initially was the Managua mine explosion in 1907, I believe, in West Virginia, Managua, West Virginia. And that was the largest mine explosion in American history up to that time. And I can't remember the exact numbers, either 494 or 497 miners were killed in instantly in that explosion.
Wow.
And that led the federal Congress to pass the Coal Mine Safety Act in 1909, 2 years later. And that Coal Mine Safety Act, it tried to persuade coal mine owners to make improvements within the mines to prevent things like this explosion. Because mm-hmm. what happened in that explosion was that coal dust is very explosive. And you mine, you get coal dust build up sometimes a foot deep in the mine. I mean, I've been in one of those mines, and you can walk into coal dust. I mean, it's real soft. It's real comfortable. It's just almost silky-like. Mm-hmm. It's so fine. It's like flair. It's about that fine. You remember, you know, how you cooking flare mm-hmm. and wheat flare. But it would build up and it's very explosive. Well, you also have pockets of methane gas in these coal mines. And remember the old open flame lamp, the carbide lamp? I said, you know, got a blaze of fire about 4 or 5 inches long on your head. And you walk through those tunnels, you come where a pocket of methane gas is accumulate, you're going to have a small explosion there, but that small explosion then will ignite the whole mine. And that's what happened at Managua. And that was a common incident. You had a lot of mine explosions at this time. It killed, you know, from 10 to 200 or 300 immigrants, mm-hmm. or 200 or 300 miners. Not all of them were immigrants. And so the federal government tried to get the coal mine companies to make their mines safer.
Okay.
And it didn't work until the union movement of the 1920s and 30s came about. And that was one big thing that the union wanted, was safe mining laws. Mm-hmm. But the Coal Mine Safety Act 1909 didn't mandate, it sort of encouraged. But most coal mine operators didn't pay much attention to it. There were no penalties for violating it. And another problem in mines at that time was, you know, they were being electrified. And some equipment, especially the bigger mines, use electricity. Well, they didn't have any insulation over the electrical wires. It's bare wires ran in the mine through the mine tunnel. If you were grounded and you touched one of those wires accidentally, you were electrocuted. That happened a lot. Mm. A lot of mine tunnels were small, dark. You couldn't see very well. And the miners would get hit by equipment because the coal was hauled out of mines in little small buggies about 2 foot high or so. And the operator actually lay down on the buggy to pull maybe 15 or 20 cars of coal that were equally, you know, 2 foot high or so. And you couldn't see anybody in front of you walking through the tunnel or fail or something. You'd get run over with the motor and get killed. And then, so the Coal Mine Safety Act tried to get coal mine operators to put safety devices in mines, you know, insulate wires, have horns and bells on equipment so that would alert somebody that in a mine tunnel that these devices were being operated, were there, get out of the way. Another thing that happened is these mines weren't ventilated well. And so you would have pockets of methane gas that would accumulate. Well, you could die by breathing that stuff, or you could have an area of the mine, which miners called white damp, was, I think, the methane gas. And then an area called black damp, which was deprived of oxygen, no oxygen in it. You walked into an area of black damp and you'd suffocate. In fact, I had an uncle an uncle who's married to my aunt, my uncle by marriage, who died in the early 1960s because he walked into an area of black damp in a mine operating illegally and suffocated and died. And but you'd have a lot of people die because of lack of oxygen. And so you could dig a tunnel into a secondary tunnel from the side of the mountain into the mine shaft, and you could operate an electrical fan and blow air in and blow that gas out and oxygenate the mine too, and prevent a lot of explosions. Mm-hmm. And the Coal Mine Safety Act tried to get coal mine operators to install electric fans, but it costs money to dig another tunnel and connect to the main tunnel. And a lot of most operators didn't do that. And so you still have the problem going on until really probably 1930s and 40s.
Wow.
In the mines, but by mid to late 1930s, pretty much unionized. And the union then began to hold enough sway with Congress to force Congress to mandate that these things be done. And so it took a while, but it happened eventually.
Well, and that this doesn't even address the whole black lung issue, you know, because this is all stuff that happens just in the mind where you could die immediately.
Yeah.
Not to say that, you know, years of
black
mining.
Lung really wasn't an issue until probably the 1960s.
Oh, so why is that?
Nobody really, people just denied that it was, you know, or at least the government didn't recognize it as an illness. In fact, I used to work in the black lung I used to work with an attorney. When I was in high school, I was his file clerk. And he happened to be a neighbor. Lived across the street from where we lived at for a while. And he specialized in filing black lung claims for coal miners. He was retired military, and that's all he did. He worked out of his house. And he happened to live in our neighborhood. And so he would hire me to file papers for him when I was in high school. And that was in the 1970s. But he had been working in that since the 1960s. It really wasn't recognized as a disease until sometime probably the late 50s, early 60s. And the federal government then began to mandate that coal companies pay compensation to miners who were the victim of black lung. And just about everybody who's worked more than 3 or 4 years in the mines has some black lung, called pneumonicosis disease. And it's basically pneumonia caused by coal dust, permanent pneumonia, and the lungs harden, and it will eventually kill people. And I've had several elders die of it, or it contributes to their death. They can't breathe and take breathing treatments, that sort of thing, for years and years before they die.
So then many, many people died before that or had permanent damage. But they died before the regulation, then they didn't qualify for any benefits.
Didn't
so the family
for any benefits. Yeah.
Wow.
You didn't really qualify for any benefits probably sometime in the 1970s.
Okay.
Activists, the union, UMWA, and other activists began to pressure the federal government to recognize pneumonicosis as a disease and to compensate or force coal companies to compensate, pay into a fund to compensate victims of that disease.
And was it at all like retroactive for the widows and the families?
The widows could get, if you could prove that your husband had the disease, but now to prove you'd have x-rays, chest x-rays, and that most widows weren't able to get chest x-rays. They were poor, their husbands had died, and they probably never had chest x-rays, couldn't get chest x-rays.
And wouldn't have thought about it either. I mean, even though maybe they knew something was wrong, but you don't think that's right. Wow. So what were some of the cultural things that happened? I know, you know, in Himmlerville, there were some interesting things that happened, but, you know, as far as the immigrants and their bringing their culture besides that boarding house kind of situation.
Well, one thing they would bring is their religion.
Okay.
Appalachia was Protestant for the most part. They brought two primary religions with them, Roman Catholicism and Greek Orthodox. Now, the main religion was Catholicism. Most of the immigrants were Roman Catholic. Not all, but most. And they wanted some place to worship, and so they would petition the Catholic Church or the bishop, whoever was the nearest bishop to them, to send a priest. And initially, these priests would come from sometimes 200 or 300 miles away, maybe take the train once a month and hold services in this coal camp. Mm-hmm. But there were so many immigrants who were Catholic that finally the Roman Catholic Church began to authorize the construction of churches in coal camps. And so a lot of coal mine operators would then donate land and some money to the Catholic Church to build a church in the coal camp. And some still exist. A real nice one is in the town of Lynch in southeastern Kentucky. It's called Resurrection Parish. It was built out of stones. In fact, it was built out of stones by Italian stonemasons. And lore has it that every family in Lynch, Kentucky, every immigrant family contributed money to buy a stone to build that church with. But most coal camps had Catholic churches, at least the larger ones did.
Okay.
Now, sometimes you'd have two or three different organizations sharing a church. You might have a Catholic sharing a Baptist church or a Presbyterian church. Which are probably the two big religions in Appalachia, Presbyterianism and Baptist at the time. But the Greek Orthodox were not as numerous, but there were a few Greek Orthodox churches in places like Lynch, larger coal camps.
Okay.
But religion was one thing they brought with them. And some of these things they brought with them, some things they created. They either created or brought with them immigrant clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Almost every coal camp would have a Hungarian club. They have an Italian club, a Russian club, a Polish club, sometimes a Lithuanian club, different organizations. And these clubs developed sort of as in lieu of insurance.
The fraternal benefits.
Fraternal.
Yeah.
Fraternal. Mm-hmm. And in those days, if you got hurt in the mine and couldn't work, tough luck, you had no workman's compensation. And you were just,
it's too bad.
You're too bad.
Yeah.
And so immigrants began to build or to create these organizations in which immigrants would pay a monthly fee usually. Mm-hmm. And initially they were created to make sure that when you died, your funeral would be held in accordance with old world customs. But as time went on, they began to pay insurance benefits, or they'd pay widows and children if a coal miner got killed in an accident, or they would provide funds for a miner if the miner got hurt and couldn't work for 2 or 3 months to pay bills.
Okay.
And these immigrant clubs were behind most of the social activities in mm-hmm. coal camps. They would hold dances. And I interviewed a bunch of immigrants, and they would all tell me about what they called the Hungarian grape dance, in which they would hold these dances to raise money for charity and for the clubs. And they said the Hungarian grape dance and both Hungarians and non-Hungarian immigrants remember those dances.
Mm-hmm.
They'd all talked about it. And they said, that they would hold a suspend fruit, grapes or some kind of fruit from the ceiling of the dance floor. And then the female dancing partner would try to entice her husband or boyfriend or whatever to steal a piece of fruit for her. And they'd have what they called marshals at the corners of the room. And they saw somebody steal the fruit. They would take the man aside and to a corner of the building and fine him. According to, they said, what his ability to pay was. An ordinary miner might be fined a few cents, but then a coal boss or a coal mine owner might be fined $10 or $15. And they used that money to further the goal of the society. And the immigrants all remembered that fondly. And they said that, the fines were paid, as they said, in good spirit, because everybody knew it was going for a good cause.
Right. And when you talked to those people, where were they from that you?
Everywhere.
Okay.
I interviewed Hungarians. I interviewed Italians. I interviewed Russians. I interviewed Polish. I interviewed a husband, wife, Pete and Tibian, T-I-E-B-I-E-N, I guess how you pronounce the name. He was Polish and she was Russian, and both their parents had operated. They lived in Lynch, Kentucky at the time. Both of them had operated boarding houses. His parent operated a boarding house for the ethnic group they were from. His father was from, and hers had operated a boarding house, the ethnic group that her family was from. And it was Polish and Russian. I don't remember which.
Which one's which? Yeah.
It's been 40 years ago, 35 years ago. They were, Bessie Funik was from Yugoslavia. Her husband, Tony, was from Yugoslavia. Tony was a mine, a foreman for Yugoslavian immigrants. Bessie worked in a boarding house.
Wow.
They were from everywhere. You would have at least more 20 or more nationalities represented in most coal camps.
Okay.
I interviewed some teachers in coal camp schools, and they said it was almost impossible to teach in those schools because you have maybe 20 or more languages spoken in your classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And they said it was awful difficult to teach because a lot of students didn't understand English. They right. understood.
Yeah. Or and, each other or anything. Yeah. I mean, that'd be very challenging. So did it sound like when these people were recalling these clubs or these fraternal organizations that would they go to each other's events then? So if you were, yes. you didn't have to be Hungarian to go to the Hungarian no. one, but, no. but they would go around to each other and support yeah. each other's events.
Yeah. They would support each other's others. Well, in many cold camps, small ones, you didn't have, you might have maybe 20 Hungarians. Mm-hmm. 25 Italian, 8 or 9 Russians, 4 or 5 Polish, that sort of. So, you know, they all pretty much had to support each other.
Sure.
Because it just wasn't enough in most coal camps to support. Now, Lynch and some of the larger coal camps are where Lynch had a population of about 10,000 people one time.
Oh, wow.
But in most coal camps weren't nowhere near that large. Most had maybe 1,000 people or less. Mm-hmm. And some 400 or 500, 200 or 300. So, yeah, they would support each other.
Well, and the opportunity to learn about somebody else's culture, mm-hmm. you know. So, wow, that's the grape harvest dance.
Yeah, you call it the Hungarian grape harvest. I asked you if you heard, you know, what it was called, something different, but it was everybody. I mean, I don't know how many people that I interviewed talked about that dance.
Wow,
they remembered. That was the one.
Yeah, I was going to say. Well, I mean, it is a little different and fun. You know, it's a fun. Fun opportunity.
I mean, they were mostly, you know, most of them who I interviewed, they were in their 70s, 80s at the time I interviewed them. And so they'd worked in the 19-teens, 1920s, 1930s, 1940s in the mines.
Wow.
And that sort of thing. And so they remembered that. For
it really stuck with them.
Stuck with them.
Yeah. Huh. Let's see. Are there still a lot of immigrants active in the mining industry now, or is it not
so much? I don't think so. I think it's pretty much gone. The mining industry would periodically go through periods of boom and bust. And the 1920s was a bust period before the year before the Great Depression. The mining industry was in depression by the early 1920s, and it stayed in depression for the next 20 years or so. And a lot of coal mines had to close down, and so immigrants lost their jobs. And when they lost their jobs, most of them then left Appalachia. By 1945 or so, most of them were gone.
Okay.
You have a few. I mean, like in Martin County, Teresa Zoldas, I'm not sure, Zsoldas, she's Hungarian. She was a librarian for the public school. She grew up in Himmlerville. She was a librarian for the public school there for years and years and years. And I wanted to interview her, but she would never let me interview her.
Shoot.
I don't know why she was shy. She would never let me talk to her. I'd love to interview her. She's dead now, but she was a librarian mm-hmm. for years.
Oh, I'm sure she knew a few
stayed. Few mm-hmm. people stayed. Most went somewhere else. They would go to another coal camp. They get a job nearby. Most of them would go to Ohio, Michigan, Chicago. Many went back to New York.
Okay.
No, it just scattered everywhere. Okay. And you'll find a few now, and a few descendants. There was one He lives in Middlesbrough, Kentucky, who was a high school teacher when I was doing the interviews. He had written a book. I can't remember his name now. He had written a book about Lynch, Kentucky. He grew up in Lynch, southeastern Kentucky, which was a United States Steel coal company hometown. He was the son of an immigrant miner.
Mm-hmm.
And he taught high school there for years and years and years and wrote that book then.
So, and it was about mining then?
About Lynch, the coal camp of Lynch.
Okay.
And growing up in Lynch.
Well, is there anything that we haven't covered that we should have covered?
Well, a lot,
at the
really,
moment. But, well, I mean, for this episode.
it was interesting. You know, the one thing discrimination. There was a lot of discrimination against immigrants mm-hmm. in the coal camps. I mean, talk about that. As I told you before, I ran across that cemetery, which was segregated on the basis mm-hmm. of race. You have one field, it's in Harlan County, Kentucky. You have one end of the field, you have immigrants buried. Another end of the field, you have African-Americans buried. And then across the road on the hill, you have Native whites buried. Immigrants were called all kinds of names, derogatory names.
Mm-hmm.
Italians are called tallies or dagos. Hungarians are called hunkies. Russians are called ruskies. Polish are called Polaks. that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the immigrants I talked to said they resented the name calling.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
And one, I've got a beautiful quotation in one of those interviews were in fact in the University of Kentucky Special Collections Library that I did with immigrants. It's where they're housed. I've got an Italian immigrant named Victor Del Point, who's got a beautiful quotation on there. And he says, I was talking about the discrimination. He says, and the name calling, he says, I didn't mind being called Talladega because that's what I am, he said. But he said, it infuriated me when somebody called me a hunky. He was Italian. You know,
so, call me a name, but just call me the right name.
A lot of names were changed. A lot of immigrant names were changed because mm-hmm. local postmasters couldn't pronounce the name. And so they would anglicize the name.
Sure. That so makes it a trick it. For census taking, yeah. You know.
Well, there was one in Hazard, I think, Kentucky, that his name was Antonio Calypso, or is that, I can't pronounce that, Italian. And the postmaster couldn't pronounce that. And so he just started calling him Frank Talley. And that's what the family name is now.
Mm-hmm.
Postmaster changed his name officially to Frank Talley. And that's what he went by, his descendants went by. That happened. But, you know, immigrants sometimes, you know, the one thing they like to do is play baseball.
Huh.
You actually have some major league players who came out of the coal camps because coal company towns, they have baseball. And they would sponsor baseball teams. And so you would have some a few immigrants who actually made it to the major leagues out of the coal camps.
That's interesting because it was what they could do. I mean,
what
if
they
that's...
could do was a way to get out. And, mm-hmm. you know, Tony Funick, the Yugoslavian immigrant, told me a story of when he was a mine boss of Yugoslavian crew. He said sometimes the coal companies would, and he spoke broken English, he said they would hire... workers based on their ability to play baseball. And he said that those ball players didn't want to work in the mine. And Tony said he always tried to make them work. He said some big man come in and see the man not working, he fired me. And, but he said don't want to work. He said they play ball pretty hard. But he was an interesting figure I interviewed. But he, you know, didn't like the fact that they hired baseball players to work in coal mines and didn't make them work much.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't like that either.
No.
Well, thank you so much for this chat. And
glad
I know
to do
we
it.
Will,
I
we
really
will...
enjoyed it. I could talk about this all day long.
Well, we will talk again because, you know, as we've already discussed just a little bit about Martin Himmler, and it's just a fantastic autobiography. And so we want to jump into that and, you know, talk about what's happening is it Martin County Historical Society? Is that how it's? Okay.
Martin County Historical and Genealogical Society.
Okay. And their project with Himmlerville. So now it's called Beauty, Kentucky, but it was called Himmlerville. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot to learn and there's a lot to talk about. And there's a lot of people who have a connection to coal mining. You know, all through that Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, Virginia, you know, all through that area. So what's that other area called for coal? You know, like you have the southern coal mines and then what's...
Well, there's the Pennsylvania fields. Coal mining developed, I guess, first in Pennsylvania. But you've got anthracite fields in Pennsylvania and the bituminous fields, and all the southern fields are bituminous, soft coal. And the anthracite's hard coal. And it's used, I think, for coking or making coke and steel mills. And that was the first coal probably mined. The Pennsylvania immigrants are a little different. You have the new immigrants working there too, but a lot of the immigrants who originally worked in Pennsylvania were the old immigrants, the Irish and the Germans.
Okay.
That's why I really don't study that field as much. It's a different field.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have Italians and Hungarians working there, but the mining industry was developed before they worked there. The immigrants who worked in the southern fields developed the industry. And a whole another topic, too, is railroads. The immigrants built the railroads into the southern coal fields, a lot of them, like the Clinchfield Railroad and the North Fork and Western Railroad and the Baltimore, Ohio. A lot of those roads were built with immigrant workers, Hungarian, Italian laborers who laid the track.
When did that happen?
The same time the mines opened. The railroad had to open before the mine could open. So in West Virginia, the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, in Virginia, the 1890s, early 1900s, in Eastern Kentucky, the 1910s, 1920s.
And so would you say that the recruitment practices for the coal mines were actually recruitment practices also for building the railroad lines? Or how did they get them to come over to
that? I don't know enough about the railroads. I mean, I've never looked into recruitment. I would assume probably they did the same thing. But I don't know. I've just looked into a little bit of the railroads dealing with immigrant labor. So a lot of the immigrant workers got into the southern coal fields because they were first workers on the railroad. They later built the railroad track, and once the track was laid, the coal mines could open, and the workers stayed behind and got jobs in coal mines.
Right. They just didn't keep, there was no need to keep going with that because now
the railroad was through building and had no job any longer. So they just worked. Coal mine owners said, I need workers. And so, you know, you're hired.
All right. Well, we will talk again.
I sure will.
We'll do more. So sounds good.
Appreciate you having me.
Thanks. Oh, you bet. Thank you so much. Well, thank you, Doug, for visiting with us today about coal mining and the Southern Appalachia coal fields. And we will look forward to talking to you again. And thank you for listening. And we'll catch you next time.
Thanks.